From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. It is Tuesday. Our Green Days gardening panel is going to be in a little bit later this hour to answer your gardening questions. And also warming up a chair in the green room is the one, the only Jinx Monsoon. Actually, Jinx's creator, Jarek Hoffer, is here. So we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But first, crime in the news every single day. And each one of the cases we hear about has correlating evidence that has to be stored someplace. The Seattle Police Department uses Building C on South Stacy Street as their evidence warehouse. It's full of guns and drugs, as you might expect. But it also houses the unexpected things like a massage table, a brass bed, skis, and arrows. So Katie Sewell decided to travel down there to find out what actually was on the shelves.
Yeah, and I met with Sergeant Cindy Grenard. She's with the evidence unit in the Seattle Police Department. She showed me around along with Detective Jeff Kappel from the Seattle Police Public Affairs Department. We started at the very front of the giant warehouse and snaked our way through, stopping at the gun locker along the way. In addition to warehousing evidence, they also store the personal belongings for people who are booked in jail.
The jail doesn't have any way of handling overflow of items, so we store all of their items that are extra beyond something that's small that can be taken into custody. Backpacks.
What we would think of as traditional, they'll get this back when they get out of jail.
Right, right. But they need to come get them because we have very limited space. If they don't, eventually they're purged.
So describe, since you and I are seeing it but other people aren't, describe what this looks like.
The shelves go 12 feet up in the air, and the volume's always changing. I mean, we're pretty much full, but the people that are incarcerated and released come back and take their items back with them. So the inventory changes on a daily basis.
Mostly backpacks, all of different colors through here. Oh, and skateboards.
Skateboards,
a lot of them.
Point Beat and at the Westlake Center, there's a lot of people who complain about skateboarders. So now we're in the gun room, and as you can see, we have a lot of guns. And everything from long rifles to handguns and homemade guns. It's surprising, you know, how many guns officers actually take off people on the street. And we burn them. I mean, we burn them, you know, a couple of times a year. We have to purge because we run out of space.
So why are some of them marked hazard? Do you know that?
It depends on the case. Some of them have actual biological items or types of evidence on them. It just depends on what it's, where the officer or detective confiscated and what the situation was. Definitely ones that have been dusted and latents have been lifted and DNA swabs, and you know, some could have bio matter on them from different incidents.
Yeah. Describe how big these guns are.
I can tell you a lot about them.
Like all of this almost this entire row, these are mostly 12 gauge shotguns, pump shotguns, a couple 30 caliber rifles. Again, a whole bunch more 12-gauge shotguns. Some of them could be 20-gauge, but just by nature, most of them are probably going to be 12, which is the most common gauge. More 12-gauges, more 12-gauges.
Are these generally coming from the street?
Because of search warrants, some of them are confiscated at incidents, from suspects, vehicles, houses.
And how long?
And some of it would be search incident to arrest. You might stop a guy for a traffic violation. He's got a felony warrant. You arrest him. You search the vehicle incident to arrest prior to impounding the vehicle, and it might be under the seat, on the floor, under a blanket, in the trunk, any number of things. And you can see how tons of them are pistol grip and short-barreled. So these are specifically designed for either close-in work or high amounts of concealability under a jacket, under the seat of a car, shooting even from a car, much more so than these are your more conventional hunting shotguns like this, where you got the big long stock and the longer barrel. That's more of a hunting rifle. Even though it's a military design, it's a 30 caliber rifle. Some of these are 22s. There's another long barrel 30 caliber. Those are both 30 caliber.
Describe to me how those are looking.
Well, I can't see them, so they're bagged, so I can see by the tags. So give me a minute, and I'll scan some of these. A lot of them are pistols. A fair number of them are also revolvers. Mostly common calibers, 22, 380, 9mm, 40 caliber, 38 special. the calibers that most people are familiar with, most Americans have heard of. They've been around for hundreds of years. So those are the major calibers that are in circulation that are being sold on the common market. So those are the same types of guns that are going to be stolen, that are going to end up in criminals' hands, and the kind of guns that we're going to take off of bad guys.
Do you have a sense of where something like these little sawed-off shotguns are coming from? The little short guys?
I could speculate. All of us could probably say from our street experience that a lot of recovered guns are stolen, whether out of a vehicle, out of a house. Like anything, just because something is legal doesn't mean that there's not a black market. Tobacco and alcohol are legal, but there's still huge black markets for both of them, and guns are the same way. There's a huge black market.
But if that was my gun and you stole it from me, I could come and get it back.
You have some way to identify that it's your gun. Right. A lot of people don't keep track of their serial numbers and they don't register. And so it's not uncommon for them to say, well, I had two shotguns and a 38 stolen, and not be able to provide us any type of serialized information.
In which case, too bad.
Yeah, there's no way to identify who it's returned to, so then we have to dispose of it.
Shall we move on? It's so quiet in this room.
What's that?
So it's so quiet in that room.
Yeah, it's nice. You don't have all the matches.
So that's Cindy Grenard and Jeff Kappel with the Seattle Police Department. And they took Katie Sewell on a tour of the evidence warehouse in South Seattle. They were just in the gun room. And odd fact, this room has a special security system that documents the names of everyone who enters it. So, Katie, after the gun room, where did you go?
Well, as Cindy and I turned the corner, re-entering the huge stacks of evidence, we found ourselves standing in front of a wall of skateboards.
Yeah, they're kind of seasonal. Warmer weather, of course, we have more people outside complaining. More people are out riding their skateboards.
You said everything gets returned to the people if they can get it back. So it's sort of like the teacher taking your slingshot and putting it in its drawer.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure of the success of how things go with skateboards. It's considered evidence. That's why it's here. But as far as where it goes beyond the criminal justice system, it's just one of those things. It's more of a nuisance crime that people want us to do something about.
Yeah. So how is it evidence then? How do you use it?
Well, I mean, it is a crime that it can be confiscated for, but I personally have never testified in a skateboard case, so I can't really answer to that.
Okay.
And then we've got the storage here for tall items that don't fit into our shelves. There's arrows and golf clubs, and you'd be surprised how many swords there are. And Seattle has an amazing number of swords, and I'll show you some of the other stuff. So this is our box area where we are able to put some items. There's odd-shaped items like the tanning bed and the massage table that clearly it's a challenge to find space, so we just kind of have them up out of the way for now.
Do you have any idea where those came from?
Vice. It's a Vice incident, and I don't know any more beyond that. I don't ask questions about some of the stuff.
A lot of computers, too, I notice.
Yeah. And we're very full. We have a challenge with retention. Now we're looking at 82, 99 years for homicide cases, 40 years for SAU, sexual assault cases. Anything involving a bike or a pedestrian, we've got 10-year retention. So, of course, that presents some storage challenges down the road. Before, the retention schedules weren't that long, but now they are. So now we have the challenge of keeping them in a safe environment and being able to keep our inventory and our record and documentation and everything all squared away.
Tell me something about how you have everything categorized. If you were trying to find my box from 10 years ago, how would you go about it?
We use barcodes, so we can identify it's in which aisle, on which shelf, in which box.
So is it safe to say that the stuff up there is maybe not coming down for 100 years?
Oh, no. Not necessarily. That's an 07 case. See, these are 08s, these are 07s. I'll show you the old ones.
Okay.
We do have old ones. Seattle is, we take in about 500 bikes or more a year that are recovered, and a lot of them are just stolen. And
good grief, it's like a bike store in here.
It's a lot. It takes a lot of space. Just simply take a picture of the serial number with your digital camera for insurance purposes and a picture of the bike. If we get a hit on it, then we return it to that owner. Then there's fun stuff.
Speakers, scooters, lawnmowers, wheelchairs, Seattle Weekly box.
Yeah. If you look up, we do have palletized our older cases. Our homicide cases are up there. And we have about 100 pallets plus of just homicide evidence, dating back to 1800s even. Yeah, some old.
Wow, 1800s.
Yeah,
so all these things, as random as they are all somehow involved in a case.
Correct. They were seized by the investigating officer detective and taken into custody and brought to the evidence unit until they were needed. Sometimes they're not, but the prosecutors like to have evidence as best evidence to present in court. And there's bumpers, and there's wheels and rims and brass beds, you name it. I mean, there's pretty much everything.
Strollers, air compressors.
Healthy thieves.
Is there anything in here that strikes you as especially interesting or odd from walking these aisles every day?
It was a headstone, and there was great concern that somebody's headstone had been stolen. And so the detective did some investigation, and there really wasn't anybody under that name who had passed away, and found out that they have a journeyman headstone carving program. So they actually let them practice doing the actual headstone carving, and then what they do is they'll sell it to landscapers who flip them over and use it as rocks in landscaping, which happened in this particular incident. A practice stone that was turned in because someone was concerned. People turn in urns of ashes. Last year it was odd. There was one left at a bus stop.
There's a certain storytelling aspect to a place like
this. Yeah, there really is. There's a lot of really interesting stories. I never imagined that evidence would be so interesting. It actually is. And I take it to heart because it's victims. It's their story. It's their life. It's how if we do something wrong, it could have a profound effect on them and the criminal justice system. We're really going to be diligent in safeguarding the evidence here.
That's Cindy Grenard with the Evidence Unit of the Seattle Police Department. She gave Katie a tour of the Evidence Warehouse in South Seattle. Now, if you think that you have something that is in that warehouse, a personal belonging, maybe your skateboard, you can check with the evidence personnel. The warehouse is open from 6 to 6 every day, and the phone number, 206-684-8720. This is Weekday.
Ten 19, a conversation with Jarek Hoffer, the man behind drag queen Jinx Monsoon, in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Sodo Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor organic garden supplies and hydroponics, featuring grow lights, fresh brewed compost tea daily, and Baker Creek seeds, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sodohydro.com.
56 degrees in Seattle. It's mostly cloudy, and it's going to stay that way. We're looking at a chance of showers today and a high of 65. 10:20. I'm Bernard Ouellette. The KUOW Green Days Gardening panel will be here to answer your growing questions in 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. You know all those studies that tell college students that they're supposed to take science and technology classes because there's no future in the arts? Well, Cornish College grad Jarek Hoffer is living proof that that's not always the case. He studied theater at Cornish, performed around Seattle, including the Fifth Avenue Theater production of Rent, and then Jarek Hoffer hit the big time. His alter ego, Jinx Monsoon, just won the fifth season of RuPaul's Drag Race. It's a national television contest. It comes with a big prize and a big title, America's Next Drag Superstar. Jarek Hoffer, did I get that title
yes,
right?
Yes, you got it. Great.
Jarek, a.k.a. Jinx, and some other characters, it's a pleasure to welcome you here to Weekday. I read, or maybe I watched an interview with you, that this character, Jinx, is sort of based on your mother?
Yeah, and it's something that kind of happened organically. Like, I didn't set out to kind of base her on my mom, but she's kind of an amalgam of all the women who raised me in my life, my aunt, my mom, and my grandma, who are all very strong, opinionated women with really good senses of humor and really bad luck. So the Hoffers are a clumsy bunch. So
well, you described Jinx as part Southern Belle and part sort of crass working girl.
Yeah, yeah.
An interesting combo. Most recently, Jinx is a sort of Marilyn Monroe peroxide blonde type.
Yeah. I think it comes with, you know, the more exposure you have, the more people want to be able to recognize you. And with drag, you have the ability to, like, recreate your look every time you hit the stage. But I kind of like the idea that when you create a drag character, she has, like, she has a hair color and she has an aesthetic. So Jinx lately has taken on the bottle blonde kind of
big
Pam Anderson hair and aesthetic. So
it is big and it kind of flips around.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you probably can flip any kind of hair, but the blonde hair seems to flip a lot. Mm-hmm. You're from Portland originally, and your first drag show, you were underage, to say the least, like 15?
Yeah, 15 was the first time I did a legit drag show, but I had experimented with gender illusion, you know, like at 14 in middle school, doing a talent show as I created a Southern psychic character, and I would read people's palms in the show. And
where did that interest come from?
You know, I remember being like 7 years old and watching Sally Jesse Raphael when they had the, you know, can you guess who's the dude? Like one of those shows. And, you know, I knew at a very early age that I was different. I didn't know what the words were for it, and I didn't know what it meant exactly. But I knew that I didn't like the same things that every other boy my age liked. And I was always very, very jealous of, you know, like, I thought women just had the better clothes, you know? I watched the Addams Family, and I thought Morticia's costume was much better than Gomez's. So.
Well, it was, except for the fact that she couldn't walk.
Yeah, well, even that seemed fun to me.
So you came to Seattle to go to Cornish, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was the intent, you studied theater, but was the intent that you were going to be a drag performer, or what were you thinking?
I've always kind of simultaneously juggled my acting career, my quote unquote legit acting career, and my drag career, because whenever you don't find work as an actor, the best advice I can give young actors is create your own work, you know? And so for a while, whenever I wasn't in a play, I would just go back to drag work, and it kept me busy. And me and my music partner created the Vaudevillians, which is an alternate drag character that I play, Kitty Witless. And it just gave us a chance to always be on stage and always be working on something.
How did sort of the, you know, serious theater training, which is what Cornish offers you, and I should say, Jarek, you graduated summa cum laude.
Yeah.
It's not like you were just sort of the dregs there over at Cornish. So you were doing well. How does that kind of training inform Kitty or Jinx or any other character that you're going to create in the drag venue?
Well, I think with education, period, you get what you put into it, you know? And at Cornish, I had this, like, epiphany sophomore year that, like, when you can kind of separate your ego from your work, you're able to really, you know, take in criticism and take in critique and take in, like, positive and negative feedback, process it and filter it and strengthen your work a lot from it. And from sophomore year on, I was just like an open receptacle for anything that would improve my work. And I took a Commedia dell'arte course junior year. And I realized that the classical form of Commedia dell'arte is essentially what I do as a drag queen. And when I started thinking of it like that, my characters took on a whole new life and they became more fully realized and had more of a backstory.
Jinx has a whole series of little videos. You can go to jinxmonsoon.com and watch them.
Yeah.
You can find them on YouTube. But one of the things that really strikes me about some of them, there's lots of characters, their body.
Yeah.
I guess that's the right word to use. But a lot of them are character studies where there's just you. and they almost read like social commentary. Yeah. There's one that you did based on what many actors have done. You worked in fast food. I think that's a true story. And essentially what you're doing is creating all the people or sort of caricatures of people that would come into to a fast food store. There's another one about drugs.
Yeah.
And to me, while they're funny, they also, it seems like it gives you that chance to make some, through this character Jinx, observe our society, observe the way people interact.
Well, that's, I think, what all good art does. I mean, people think that comedy, because it's comedic and because it's designed to make you laugh, that it doesn't have room to be really poignant and to be that kind of social commentary. But I think comedy is, you know, just as serious as any form of art. And art is designed to make you kind of reflect upon your setting and your environment and kind of hold that mirror up to society. So I like to find ways to do that through even the most, like, crass little video shorts that I do.
Some of them are, they're crass.
Yeah.
Some are not rated for prime time. I should say that for sure. You have an entourage. Mm-hmm. The Jinx character is a mom.
Yeah.
with a gay son who's the actor is gay, but this is a friend of yours and he's not your son.
Yeah.
how big an entourage is there at this point around Jinx Monsoon?
Well, I mean, she just kind of keeps collecting people in her storyline. I just have fun. A lot of my, you know, my best friends are the same age as me, and in the gay community, we're referred to as twinks, you know, like young, skinny, kind of androgynous, femi-gay boys, you know. So there's a joke of Jinx and her twinks, and it's fun to pretend when I'm going out with my friends and I'm in full drag and they're themselves that, like, it's just someone brought their mom to the gay club and she's like the hip mom who's cool with her gay son and hangs out with all his friends and stuff like
that. Well, she actually embarrasses her gay son.
Yeah. Yeah.
Often.
Well, and that's a kind of, when we started doing, the web show Monsoon Season, which is, a very tongue-in-cheek setup of Jinx Monsoon and her son and her struggles as a failing actress. And when we started doing that, I realized it was very similar to my relationship with my mom. Like, the mom trying desperately to be hip, but she, but her and her gay son have, you know, points of connection and then points of distress.
How did your mom feel about seeing Jinx Monsoon the first time? Did she recognize herself?
My mom thinks Jinx is based on my aunt. My aunt thinks Jinx is based on my mom. So they both try to push it off on someone else. But, I don't know. It's been fun for me and my mom. Like, she's become a big drag fan, in the last couple of years. My mom, when I first told her I was a drag queen, was really worried about my safety, you know? Cause she grew up in a completely different time and a different locale. And, she was worried that, you know, being a teenage drag queen was going to be very dangerous for me. But, luckily, you know, I live in a time in a, you know, a part of the world where teenagers are more and more comfortable coming out at an early age, which I think is, really important to the development. I mean, I feel like coming out at 14 and being able to be open with my family and my friends at that early of an age let me really start to, you know who I was at a much earlier age than gay kids used to get, or gay kids in different parts of the world have the opportunity to do. So
we're talking with Jarek Hoffer, and you may know Jarek as Jinx Monsoon or Kitty Witless from the Vaudevillians. And the Vaudevillians are actually going to New York for a run, which is pretty exciting. Do you, at this point, in the aftermath of being America's Next Drag Superstar, great title, by the way, are you getting maybe emails or texts from kids who were like you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's pretty much every day I get some kind of email, Facebook or Twitter message or something like that. Social media has connected me with my fan base in a way that I don't think was possible 5 years ago. And I hear all the time kids who have had similar struggles to me, or, you know, people who are still going through their own struggles right now. And it's not that I set out, you know, doing RuPaul's Drag Race to become a role model for teenagers struggling with their identity and all that stuff. But the fact that it's giving me this opportunity, it's given me a responsibility to my fan base and to my audience to, you know, give them that thumbs up and say, as long as you're taking care of yourself and being safe, you know, seek out your dreams and give them a chance.
How does one get on RuPaul's Drag Race?
Well, first you have to decide you want to do it, which is, you know, an inner battle.
it's a big time commitment, isn't it?
It's a huge time commitment, and it's very competitive. And, you know, it's hard to put yourself out there for that kind of judgment and critique, but it's definitely worth it, because nothing will up your drag game like going on RuPaul's Drag Race. So.
Did you have to audition?
Yeah, you send in a video audition, then there's a lot of interviewing and screening, processing and stuff, and it's not easy because thousands of drag queens every year at this point now audition for it, and then they select 12 to 14. So even just making it onto the show any given year is a huge thing as a drag performer.
Where do you go to do all this?
LA. It's filmed in LA, and it was actually only my second time in LA, and being a Pacific Northwesterner, I was just constantly with a case of the vapors, and I would coat myself in SPF 110 before I left my hotel every day.
That's actually one of your beauty tips.
Yeah.
There are, it's interesting because I think it was Elle magazine posted beauty tips. So I thought, well, that's an, you know, it's you giving me beauty tips. So there you go. You're a little bit younger than me, but SPF 110 is probably a good tip for everybody.
Well, I get all the time, people from LA and New York and Florida meet people from the Northwest, and they can't believe how young we look. And first they comment on how pale we are, but then they comment on how young we look, and they don't realize that the two go hand in hand. Like,
don't sit out in the sun. You'll look better. This is a question I've always wondered. How long does it take you to put all that makeup on? Mm-hmm.
It takes, depending on the night and the look that I'm achieving, it takes about 2 to 3 hours. I've spent about 4 hours at 4 to 5 hours sometimes, you know, doing specialty looks and stuff. It takes no less than two hours.
How did you learn how to do that?
Well, it's, a combination of, theater makeup and learning the old school tricks from other drag queens and stuff. So there's all kinds of, tricks of the trade, you know, that you learn. And, but also taking stage, makeup classes really helped me, because there's a lot you can learn about, contour and highlight, mm-hmm. and stuff, specifically for the stage and spotlights and stuff like that, that'll help you as a drag queen.
Another question I had was whether RuPaul was nice.
Oh, RuPaul, what you see is what you get with RuPaul. Like, she's every bit the genuine, authentic, nice person that she appears on the show. And she's got a really quirky sense of humor that I don't think always shows through the show, but in person, She gets every joke, and if you're paying attention, you can parse out these little obscure references and really hilarious jokes that she just kind of makes on the sly.
So as the winner of this long, intensive reality show, you got money, you've got exposure, you're going touring more than you did, but you are sort of back and forth in Seattle. And next week, you go back on the Fifth Avenue stage. I mentioned introducing you were in Rent, but you're going to be in this concert production of Hairspray. So are you playing a particular role?
I'm playing Velma Von Tussle, who is kind of the villainess of the story. And she's actually the retired pageant queen, which is funny because that's kind of the antithesis of who I've been this year. but it's my favorite role in the show. I don't normally play the villain. I normally play, well, lately I just play people who die in the second act. But I'm really excited because Debbie Harry and Michelle Pfeiffer have both immortalized this role, and I'm excited to put my own flair on it. So
looking ahead, I don't know if you can look ahead past the busy summer that you have. Do you envision a musical theater career or a continuation in drag or both?
I don't want to give up either. I say all the time, for me, there's no theater without drag, and there's no drag without theater. And even though... you know, I'd be willing to take male roles in theater. I have the most fun getting to play female roles because it's just always been, like, it's always my favorite role in the show.
Well, you need to go back in time to the Elizabethan era,
yeah.
where there were no women on stage.
Well, I mean, it's my dream that... that people, you know, like, the way theater is headed, that the constructs of gender continue to be broken down so that it's just the right actor for the right role. And it doesn't matter whether you're female-bodied, male-bodied, or what, because there's ways to transform all of that, you know. But I think we're headed in the direction that the right actor can play any role, male or female. And my dream is to keep doing as much drag in theater as possible.
So I'm going to end this by reading an email from one of our listeners. Mm-hmm. Sandy, she says, my partner Rachel is a friend of yours, loves RuPaul's Drag Race. Me, I really dislike reality TV. that being noted, I've seen Jarek perform in a few shows. My friend Greta talked about his talents when he graduated from Cornish, so I knew he'd be something to see. I watched the full season of RuPaul's Drag Race. Jarek, you handle yourself with such respect for yourself and for the other contestants. I'm really proud of the human being that you are. I've only met you once. I think you did a tremendous service to show that the whole diva behavior is not the only way to be a drag queen. So with that, we thank you and wish you good luck.
Well, thank you so much for having me today.
look forward to having you here in some other incarnation as well. Jarek Hoffer lives in Seattle, traveling the country now because Jinx Monsoon, his alter ego, is America's next drag superstar. Jinx will be in New York, all around the country. The Vaudevillians, which is Jarek's other sort of alter
creative outlet.
That's good. Thank you. We'll be in New York. And then next weekend, as you heard, Jarek's going to be in the concert production of Hairspray, the 10th anniversary production at the Fifth Avenue Theater.
Yeah.
This is Weekday.
I'd like to propose a toast. Here's to the ladies in drag. Everybody clap. Covered in makeup to hide all our sags, spilling cocktails in our lap.
10:39. Gardening advice in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from City People's Mercantile on Sandpoint Way and City People's Garden Store and Landscape Design in Madison Valley, offering a wide selection of plants, patio furniture, and outdoor living accessories. Locally owned for more than 30 years. More at citypeoples.com.
I'm Marvin Alney. On the next To the Point, the big data grab by U.S. intelligence agencies may be overreach or welcome protection, but Americans in the smartphone and Facebook generation might not be outraged by perceived violations of privacy. Is America's public square now digital? Is it too late to change the rules of Silicon Valley? Next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.
That's just about a half an hour away on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. You count on KUOW to provide you with intelligent reporting that nurtures your knowledge. KUOW takes you beyond the headlines, gives you a deeper perspective on important issues. Right now is a great time to renew your annual KUOW membership or make a special gift. You may have received a special appeal in the mail. Please mail back your gift or make it online at KUOW.org by June 30th. And thanks. 55 degrees, mostly cloudy in Seattle. Expecting to reach 65 this afternoon with clouds all day and a chance of showers. 10:41. Police in Turkey are cracking down on protesters. That's in the news at 11.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman, and even when the weather isn't perfect, like today. We do have a lot going on in our Puget Sound area gardens. Our gardening experts are here once again to give you advice, and here they are alphabetically. Laura Matter, practicing horticulturalist, the coordinator of the Garden Hotline for Seattle Tilt. Greg Rayburn, Vashon Basin steward, co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. And Marty Winget, back from roaming the world. She's a travel and garden writer, and you can find her online at martywinget.com. Where were you just briefly?
England, all over. London, Hampshire, Cornwall, Gloucestershire.
And it's raining over in Europe, I hear.
Well, we did have some cool and wet weather to begin with, but the weather got better while we were there, so it was fun to see the gardens.
Well, all right, gardens. That's our topic. 206-543-5869. And here's something that you will not have not heard. You will have heard this before. Hans writes, "Help! Exclamation. How do you get rid of horsetails? Does vinegar work? Is there something better? They're really mixed in with stuff I don't want to kill. They're overrunning my raspberries, my gardens, my life. Any help? 2 out of 3 of these problems is cool. P.S. They seem worse than last year." Vinegar is not going to do it, is it?
No.
All right. What should he do?
I learned to live with my horsetails because, you know what? They're going to outlive me. So...
It is isn't it the world's oldest plant or somehow?
I'm sure it's ancient. In the running for it. Now, in the raspberries, the best you can do is break it off. Just break it. Don't try to dig it up. Just break it off. But in an ornamental garden, I would say try planting taller plants.
Exactly. To hide the horsetail?
Yeah, that's exactly. All. Just hide it.
Now, am I right that it's like bindweed in that if a little bit of it breaks off, it then grows another tail?
I don't
tail?
Think it acts quite like bindweed that way, but it does have an extensive root system. And so I remember George Pinu, our former extension agent, saying the horsetail at your house is probably the same horsetail 6 doors away.
Or around the world in Australia is what he used to say. It's one plant that circles the world. So... Essentially, Hans, they're saying just deal with it, live with it.
Yeah, taller plants will help shade it out. So it prefers sunshine and lots of moisture. If you can correct some of the moisture issues, if you can shade it out, you won't get rid of it entirely, but you can diminish it.
It looks really nice with ferns, too.
It is. It's a lovely.
It's a lovely combination.
You're such a half glass full kind of guy, Greg. look at it and love it is the question. Our phone number, if you've got a gardening question, is 1-800-289-5869 or 206-543-5869. Judy in Issaquah, you are on the air.
Hi. I want to know if I need to, what I need to do with the iris once they're finished blooming. Do I leave the greens on like they do with tulips and daffodils or what?
Are these bearded iris, the really tall sort, they have sword-like leaves?
Beautiful. Mm-hmm.
You can, once the flowers fade, and often there's more than one flower on a stalk, so you kind of have to wait. You can certainly cut the flower stalks off, but leave the foliage there, and it provides a nice vertical accent in the garden to other things going on. You don't have to do anything with the leaves.
So, okay. And I have another question.
Sure.
A bleeding heart question. Is it possible to have both red and pink flowers on one bleeding heart plant?
Well... I suppose that flower colors, I'm wondering if this is the great big bleeding heart or the little native bleeding heart.
It's huge.
So the flowers are, you know, like 3/4 of an inch or something, the little pillow-like flowers.
They're beautiful. I want a piece of that from my neighbor, but I don't know how to propagate it.
I would look and see how it's growing from the ground. Do you want the dark color? Is that what you're asking about? Oh, you want it all. Usually perennials can be divided, and this may not be the best time to do it. It might be in fall, and if your neighbor is willing to, if it's a big enough patch and your neighbor is willing to give up some of it, you can divide it thin with a sharp shovel.
Just like you would do hosta.
Yeah.
Okay. That's so exciting.
Have fun out there, Judy.
Maybe you can trade some horsetail for it.
Well, speaking of horsetail, Nuria's in Bellevue, and you have a horsetail attack method, Nuria?
Yes, I once was given this piece of advice by someone who had a patch that was not too big, but he said that he was just really, really persistent about just clipping the horsetails. He had a little pair of scissors tied to a twig nearby, because he said that all of the energy was being spent by putting up more shoots instead of spreading more roots, and eventually it depleted its energy and it died.
Yes, you can keep. Yeah, that's a good idea. You can keep after it, and you'll get smaller and smaller horsetail, but you do have to be persistent.
And if you do have a small area also, you can excavate all the root, but once it's widespread through the garden, that's when you're pretty much.
And if you want to exercise, you can be digging it up. Nuria, thanks for that. Didn't we talk about snipping something last week, carrying around little.
Yeah, morning glory.
Morning glory. So,
same sort of thing.
So they all need, like most plants, they need sun to keep being healthy. So this attack method is going right at basic biology that you learned in middle school. We've got a lot of lines full, so we'll try to get to as many of your calls as possible. Dan's in Tacoma. Hello.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Go ahead, Dan.
Oh, hi. So my question is, I have some critters that took off the bark on a magnolia tree, a young magnolia tree, only a 2 years old, and wondering if there's anything I can do to repair the tree, because it's starting to look like it's suffering.
Is the bark stripped all the way around?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably on the lower, 8 inches. 10 inches, but it is stripped off all the way around.
That can sometimes be hard to come back from that's essentially girdling a tree. The live part of the tree, where all the nutrients are moving, is right under the bark, and that can get easily damaged by having critters chew on the bark. I had that happen with goats I used to own on Vashon. They did that to a large Madrona tree, and I did lose it. So I wouldn't advise putting anything on that. That's not going to really make any difference.
Oh, no. That's sad news, Dan. Sorry.
Yeah. What about, can I amend the soil? I mean, do you think I can do anything to get it through this kind of stress period?
Well, it's a matter of whether it can heal itself. Certainly just taking good care of it. I wouldn't do anything extraordinary, though. A lot of times people can overcompensate, and you can kill plants with too much attention to doing too much to it, making too many changes to the soil. So just do whatever you normally do and see if it can heal itself.
Yeah, drought would be probably the greatest risk stressor to it. So just make sure it has adequate moisture.
Well, good luck with that, Dan. Another horsetail call. Freya?
Oh, hi. I tried to organically deal with my horsetail in Montlake. I worked for 20 years. Nothing worked. And then I got chickens, and to my surprise, they decimated it within one season.
Excellent.
It's gone, and it has not come back.
Wow.
That's great.
Wow. Well, thank you for that.
If a person can do that.
Oh, I love that. Thanks so much for sharing that story. I think we could write a book called,
Chickens Are the Solution.
Yeah. Well, they're a solution to a lot of things. Diana's up on Whidbey Island, and she emails, "It is everywhere. Scotch broom everywhere on Whidbey this year. The worst we've had, it seems. Is it really possible to get rid of it? And if so, how?"
Yeah, fortunately, it's not one of the worst weeds to get rid of. It doesn't spread by rhizomes. It's a prolific seed producer, but it doesn't have rhizomes. So as long as you pull it up, and down here in King County, and I suspect up in Whidbey Island as well, you can borrow or purchase what's called a weed wrench, and it's like a big pair of pipe fitters or pliers that's attached to a huge levering handle.
So, wow.
And you put this around the base of the Scots broom, and it just uses a four foot handle to lever the broom out of the ground.
Wow.
Now, when you do that, you tend to disturb the soil and germinate more seeds. But one thing I would definitely advise you not to do is rent a piece of equipment and go out and just try and bulldoze the stand down. I've seen multiple people do that, and every time it just creates this incredible new seed bank that then the Scott's broom comes back. So look up a weed ranch, and sometimes conservation districts and other organizations, the land trust up there might also have them.
A weed wrench.
Yes.
Weed wrench. Well, good luck with that. That sounds like a big job, too.
Oh, no, it's fun.
I see it popping out of the ground yeah. and soil flying everywhere. Yeah. So wear glasses.
That's sort of like the flame thrower yeah. version yeah. of weed removal. And if I'm not mistaken, Greg Rayburn, you are partial to flames as well.
Yeah, in the right place. It can be thoroughly enjoyable to char your steak and control weeds in one fell swoop.
It sounds like a Father's Day activity. We're talking gardening with Greg Rayburn, Marty Winget, and Laura Matter. And we go now to Briar, where Ramona's holding. Hi, Ramona.
Probably, you know, 20 or more years old, and I didn't plant it, but I moved to this house about 2 years ago, and each year it has more and more needles, and I'm trying to figure out what could be going wrong.
We're going to have you take the answer off the air because it's hard to hear you, Ramona. Her Atlas cedar is turning brown. The needles are turning brown.
I would take a sample of that into your local Master Gardener clinic, because if there is a disease problem, they can discover what it is. If nothing has changed, if Atlas cedars are drought-tolerant once established, and it sounds like this should be established, so if nothing else has changed around it, then have the Master Gardeners look at it.
Okay, good luck with that, Ramona. Our phone number, 206-543-5869. We have a lot of emails. Let the horsetails live, says Michael. Horsetail are an ancient plant, incredibly unique. Learn to appreciate the horsetail. We even use them as centerpieces for our wedding.
Love that.
I think the theme of today,
yes.
horsetails. Don is on Bainbridge. He says, we've got a wisteria that's at least 8 years old. It grows vegetatively, but it's never bloomed. What can we do to force it to blossom?
Well, if the wisteria is a seed-grown plant, you may be out of luck. You may not
really
get very many flowers, if you ever get any. The best flowering wisteria are those that are propagated by cuttings from a really good flowering wisteria, so you know what you're getting.
Really?
Also, sometimes wisteria can take a long time. If it's only 8 years old, you know, maybe you have to wait a little longer. I think the other thing to look at is it near, for example, a lawn that gets a lot of nitrogen fertilizer, because nitrogen promotes leafy growth.
But not flowering.
But not flowering. So mm. Those are some things to look at.
Oh, I hope he's not out of luck. 8 years of your life and you're never going to get a blossom?
Yeah, but you could find a big one in a nursery in bloom and then you would know.
Our phone number, 1-800-289-5869 or 206-543-5869. Kathy says, I have an established Cornuscusa, a dogwood, that's suddenly dying branch by branch. Initially, I thought it was a reaction to last fall's hot, dry weather. I was on a lengthy trip and unsure how much water it actually got. But now a couple of branches that leafed out earlier are drying up. Any ideas about what's going on?
I would really inspect the bark and look for canker. There'll be like open wounds. They're obvious when you see them. There's like a raised ridges or an open wound. Sometimes they're weepy. And maybe perhaps it has a disease of some kind.
Isn't Cornuscusa the dogwood that's supposed to be hardy here?
It is resistant to anthracnose that will attack our native dogwood and also the pink flowering, the eastern dogwood.
I do like those pink flowering dogwood.
Yeah, they're lovely. There's a pink flowering kusa called Satomi.
Sometimes what you mentioned about the plant being dried out last year, sometimes there is a delayed reaction to things too. So you could have had root damage, plants start to leaf out, and then they fail because they don't have the root system to support that.
So does that mean the end?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think Greg's on, you know, you need to inspect and see if there's a disease issue. And if that's not happening, then try to take good care of the tree, trim out the deadwood and see what it does.
It really astounds me how long like a cut branch or something will continue to bud and leaf out and think it's
even though it's dead.
Really try.
An apple tree with all the roots that were eaten off of it. And so it was just like a little sharp point. And it went, and that happened in like last November. And it went ahead and it leafed out. I mean, it started to form buds this year and it just started to break leaf. And then it finally realized.
Oh, I'm dead.
I'm dead.
Wow.
Zombie plants.
Huh, that's a whole other topic. Rob from Lake Forest Park writes, I've got two camellia bushes, trees, one's in the backyard, one's on the south side of my house. Both grow and look good, but they never bloom. They did bloom 5 years ago. I've fed them. They're in a perfect spot, just like in the arboretum. They get sun and shade. I've got fir trees. Is that a problem?
I wonder if they're ever pruned, because if you prune camellias at the wrong time of year, you're cutting flower buds off. They'll form... It doesn't seem, yeah, so you need to, right after they're flowering, you can prune them. But otherwise, they're forming flower buds that you don't even see. You don't even notice them. So
is that the problem, Rob?
And perhaps they're getting a little more shade than they do in the arboretum.
With those fir trees. Don't take down the fir trees, though.
No, I didn't say that.
Okay.
No.
Kim says, I've heard rhubarb can get too big and you should divide it up. Is it true? And how do I go about doing that?
It can get big. It's quite dramatic when it gets big. It is great and easy to divide. You can share it with other people. And it's easy to do. I would wait until the fall and then just divide pieces off of it. You can pop the whole thing out of the ground and inspect the root system and sort of pull it apart, or you can take a sharp knife and kind of cut through it. You just need to make sure that the pieces you have some root system on them. But you can take one little segment of that, pop it back in the ground, get another big plant in no time.
We have this message from Bernadette. There's actually a Scotch broom petition drive and legislative action. Allison Halpern of the State Noxious Weed Group is somewhat sympathetic to having a whack a Scotch broom day. They're sympathetic, but not much else. They're trying to get Scotch broom designated as a noxious weed. Do you think deserves that category? Categorization.
Isn't it on the list already?
I thought it was.
Yeah, but the way the list works is that if you have a more highly regulated weed, those are the ones that aren't so widespread yet. So we're trying to stop the next Scots broom from.
Okay. So it's a proactive.
Yeah, you have to focus someplace where it's so widespread. You should still control it, but it'd be tough to require everyone to do it.
Just a last word. You might find that weed wrench called Grandpa's Weeder. Moss emails in, and we've run out of time. But I know everyone's going to go out and get one of those weed wrenches or a flamethrower and hit the gardens. Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin Steward, co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. Laura Matter coordinates the garden hotline for Seattle Tilth. Marty Wingate writes about gardens and travel. Check out her website, martywingate.com. Nice to have you back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell with Jason Pagano and Amina Al-Sadi. Bernard Ouellette's the engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Terry Rotero, the chef in the hat, joins us tomorrow, and we'll look inside the deep, dark crevices of the refrigerator and reconstitute culinary genius. All on Weekday on KUOW.
Well, one special session apparently just wasn't enough, so now it's special session round two in Olympia. KUOW's Lisa Brooks has our full report in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and digital HD services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Fry Art Museum, presenting Buster Simpson, Surveyor, the first career retrospective exhibition of the Seattle artist working in the field of urban environmentalism and art in public spaces. Opening June 15th. Details online at frymuseum.org.
The governor standing.